Here is your Radio Theater Channel weekly podcast for download. The RTC still has the very best old-time radio on the live streaming. And if it's music you love, tune in to the RTC Music Channel, where this link and many others are on our website at oldtimeradiolisten.com. Now, here's Jim.
Thanks for tuning in to the RTC Weekly Download. I'm your host, Jim Dolan. Today, we start off with some comedy. Eddie Cantor was a comedian, and you may remember Eddie Cantor. He was very popular early in the 30s, mainly, before World War II. He had the big eyes. You remember that, maybe? So we have an episode of his program from January 3rd, 1945, and Rochester comes to visit.
The following program is rebroadcast by the Armed Forces Radio Service to our fighting men overseas.
Bristol Myers, makers of Sal Hepatica for the smile of health, and True Shave, the beforehand lotion, present the Eddie Cantor Show. Ladies and gentlemen, in the early part of New Year's Eve, Eddie Cantor put on a show for the servicemen at the Hollywood Canteen. We turn back the clock and pick Eddie up as he's singing for the boys.
G.I. Joe, he was with the show when the boys invaded France. He stopped the shell by chance and met romance in an ambulance. Cute Marie was a nurse and she stole Joey's heart away. While convalescing day by day, he'd look at her and say, oh, Frenchie, Frenchie, although your language is so new to me. When you say oui, la, la, we mean you and me, la, la, oh, Frenchie. Oh, Frenchie, Frenchie, you won my heart with your bravery. Martin, Martin, with any boy you see. But when you la, 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 oh, Frenchie, save your la, la, la's for me.
Oh, Frenchie, Frenchie, you are the one game and bell for me. Martin, Martin, with any boy you see.
But when you la, 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 oh, Frenchie, save your ooh-la-las. They're just sweet la-la-las. Save your ooh-la-las for me.
Thank you. Thank you, all you nice fellas down here at the Hollywood Canteen. I'm glad you like the show. And now, if you really want to see the old year go out and the new year come in, I want to invite all of you over to my house at 1014 Roxbury Drive. What do you say? Harry, Harry Bonzell and I leave first to get things ready. So come on over, all of you men in uniform. Come on, Harry.
Okay, I'm ready, Eddie.
Come on, Nora.
I'm ready.
Come on, Leonard, let's go. What do you say?
Hey, Eddie, will you be careful the way you're driving?
Gee, I'm so excited. And you two kids in the back, Leonard and Nora, the way you're necking, you're not helping me one bit, you know.
Oh, Mr. Cantor.
Say, Eddie, it was a swell show you put on tonight for all our fighting men.
Yes, Harry, we had soldiers, sailors, Marines, aviators. In fact, we only missed one branch of our fighting men.
Who was that?
Tommy Dorsey couldn't show up.
Oh.
But it was a lot of fun, wasn't it, Harry?
Oh, it sure was. Say, did you see the fellow who just got back from overseas dancing with Dorothy L'Amour?
Dancing? Did you say dancing?
Yeah.
When they finished jitterbugging, she was wearing his campaign ribbon.
No.
Oh, yes. And she deserved them, you know. You know, she saw as much action as he did.
You know something, Eddie? During intermission, I tried to dance close to Carol Landis, but it was impossible, so I just danced.
I know. Why was it impossible to dance close to her?
There was a Marine in the middle.
You know, everybody talks about how the servicemen dance. Did you ever get a load of the women in the service, Harry?
Now, they really toss you around.
You said it. I happened to dance with a Red Cross nurse, and when we got through, I needed her. Just before the music started, she got set in a rumba pose.
Uh-huh.
In the front, she was all bent over, and from the back...
Yeah?
She looked like she was trying to get away on furlough. By the way, Leonard, your music... Really, kid, your music was wonderful tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Cantor. I sure had a swell time.
I could have enjoyed myself more if Leonard weren't so jealous. He kept watching me every time I danced with a soldier or Marine.
Well, sure, I was worried. The only time I didn't have to watch her was when she danced with a sailor.
Yeah. Really? Why didn't you watch her then?
I had to watch the sailor. blame you. Gosh, I sure got embarrassed watching. You see, I don't know how to dance, so Nora and I just had to stand on the floor with our arms around each other. And you know something?
What?
It's better that way.
Oh, I'm so anxious for Leonard to know how to dance. I asked him to go to Arthur Murray's, but he refused.
Well, why, Leonard?
Well, how would you like to learn how to dance with Arthur Murray?
No.
You don't understand, Leonard. Arthur Murray teaches dancing, but he also has hundreds of girls.
Well, gee, then how does he find time to teach dancing?
Leonard, did you ever have a talk with your mother about life?
Oh, yes, and now we subscribe to it. And time, too, and look. Click and peck and...
Oh, shut Leonard, up, will you please?
Oh, Mr. Cantor, isn't this your house, 1014 Roxbury Drive?
1014, yes.
That's it.
Let's go out and get into action.
Here
come on,
go.
Kids. Anybody home?
Hello? Hello?
How do you do?
What are you doing in the dining room? Why aren't you in the kitchen?
I am having trouble with the cook.
Well, Russian, the cook is young and beautiful.
That's my trouble. I hate.
Russian, will you get in the kitchen and prepare the food?
Not me, no, sir. I'm leaving. Your house is too big. Running upstairs, downstairs, up the attic, down the basement. I'm all worn out from running.
Yeah, but Russian, why do you have to run?
The cook is not standing still, you know.
Now, listen here, Russian. Listen to me. Eddie's got guests to serve out there. Now, you go back in there and make up with the cook.
Never. Never. She insulted me. She refused to permit me to make my specialty. Mm-hmm. Turnovers with tartar sauce.
Turnovers with... Is it good?
Good? Once in old Russia, I cooked my special turnovers for Prince Romanov.
Oh, well, what happened?
2 weeks after he died, he was still turning over.
Oh, yes, I told you, Eddie. Look, Russian,
what?
I don't think you know anything about cooking at all.
But most, yes. I wrote a book on recipes.
Yes?
In poetry. Part one, yes. Page one.
Go ahead.
There once was a butcher named Hutton, whose wife was a glutton for mutton. He sneaked up behind her, pushed her in the grinder. No Hutton, no mutton, no glutton, no nothing.
No Hutton, no mutton, no glutton.
No Russian, I quit.
Wait a minute. Russian, you can't quit now. It's the night of my party.
I, sir, tender my resignation. And if it's tender enough,
yes,
I'll eat it.
Oh, get out of here, Russian, please. Oh, darn, that Russian trying to kiss all my cooks. A fine mess that leaves me in... Oh, Nora.
Yes, Mr. Cantor.
Listen, honey. Go into the living room and sing a couple of songs to the boys.
All right.
I've got to get busy and get some help for the party. The Russian and the cook both walked out.
Walked out? Why?
Well, the cook got mad at the Russian for what he did,
uh-huh.
And the Russian got mad at the cook for what she didn't.
Oh.
Now, go ahead, Nora, will you?
Say, Eddie.
Yeah.
That pretty cook of yours just came back.
Oh, good, Harry. Where is she?
Yeah, she's gone.
Yeah. I thought you said she just came back.
Yeah, well, she just came back for a bottle of Touché, the beforehand lotion.
I'd get her what?
Touché. T-R-U-S-H-A-Y, Truchet.
I know how to spell Truchet, but what about the cook?
Cook, C-O-O-K.
No. Harry, don't be so smart.
Well, I'm not being smart, but the cook is being smart, coming back for that bottle of Truchet.
You call that being smart?
Why, certainly. She knows, like so many busy women, that Truchet is just the thing to use to help keep her hands soft and lovely in spite of hot soapy water. And Truchet will really do that because Truchet is based on a different idea than other hand lotions. Truchet is a beforehand lotion. A lotion that you put on your hands before you put them in hot, soapy water. Truchet's beforehand protection will then help guard your hands from the rough, drying effects of the hot, soapy water. Help keep your hands softer, smoother, lovelier. So why not do what thousands of lovely women are doing to help keep their hands beautiful? Begin today to use Truchet.
All right, Harry. You've convinced me that my cook was smart and Truchet is wonderful.
Good.
But right now, try to see if you can find anyone we can hire to help in the kitchen. Someone to cook.
Someone to cook?
Yeah.
Eddie, you've got 5 daughters living right here in the house.
Harry, if they could cook, do you think they'd still be living in this house?
Well, I tell you what, let's do.
Let's go in and hear Nora sing to the boys, huh?
Oh, yes. Let's do that, huh?
Okay.
Here she goes.
Somebody should be fixing refreshments. What are you going
to
do?
Look, Harry, I put in a call for Jack Benny to see if I can borrow Rochester.
Oh, good. Well, I hope Jack's home.
Yeah, I hope so. I know last New Year's Eve he went to Ciro's, you know.
Yeah, Ciro's? That's $15 a head. Don't tell me Jack Benny paid that.
No. Leave it to Benny. When he found out it was $15 a head, he got down on his hands and knees and backed in. Oh, this must be Benny.
Uh-huh.
Hello, Jack. This is Eddie Cantor. Yeah. Say, Jack. I hate to bother you on New Year's Eve, but I wanted to ask you a little favor. Hello? Hello? Rochester, put Mr. Benny back on the phone. Tell him it's not money. What a coward. Look, Jack, I brought a lot of servicemen over here from the canteen, and I need someone to help me with the sandwiches and refreshments. In fact, I'm even willing to pay $5. No, Jack, you shouldn't leave your guests for that. No. Jack, look, would you let me borrow Rochester? He's busy what? Shampooing your hair. Well, let him bring it with him. We'll dry it and send it back tomorrow. You will send Rochester, right? Oh, thanks, Jack. You're a pal. Send him to my house, you know, 1014 Roxbury Drive. Harry.
Here I am, Eddie. I was just getting my baby so he can pin the 1945 banner across his chest.
Good. Everything's going to work out. Rochester's coming over to help. And at 12 o'clock, we'll bring Eddie Cantor Von Zell Jr. out as the New Year's baby.
Yeah. Gosh, my kid's first New Year's.
You're going to be the New Year's baby for all the servicemen. What do you think of that, little fella?
Goo.
There goes that goo again. He says nothing else. I wonder what he's trying to say when he says goo, Harry, huh?
Goo. Look at me with his New Year's banner. Mother's starting to pin things on my chest. Oh, I get it. 1945. That's the New Year. It'll be a big year for me, too. I'll have teeth. When I have teeth, I can stop that nasty habit of sucking my thumb. I'll be able to bite my nails. Funny, Popeye's hair ain't gray. I'll bet he touches it up. I like Popeye, except the way he plays. I wished he'd stop throwing me up in the air. Either that or start catching me. Popeye's likes me. For Christmas, he gave me a piggy bank, and on the bottom it says, "When sealed, bring to the bank, 1014 Roxbury Drive." Wish it was 12 o'clock so the new year would be here. It'll be a big year for me. I'll be learning to walk and to talk. All I can say now is, goo. Oh, well, that's better than nothing. So happy goo year, everybody. Happy goo year.
Harry.
Yes, Eddie.
Harry, put the baby back in his crib until 12 o'clock.
Yeah.
Then you can go in with Leonard and Nora and help entertain the boys.
Oh, there's somebody at the door, Eddie.
I'll get it. Well, hello, Rochester.
Hello, Mr. Cannon. Well, what do I do? Where do I do it? And how much do I do it for?
Same old Rochester. Rochester, why don't you take advantage of the new year and turn over a new leaf?
Oh, I made up some New Year's resolutions. First of all, I'm going to stop shooting craps.
Wonderful, Rochester.
And I ain't going to tell a single lie.
That's fine.
Unless it's because I've been out shooting craps.
Shame on you. Let me tell you something about telling the truth, Rochester. There was once a great American, George Washington.
George Washington? He lives next door to me.
No. Rochester, the George Washington I'm talking about was a president. The George Washington that lives next door to you must be a duplicate.
Duplicate? He's a carbon copy.
Well, Rochester, it's getting late, so here's $5. I want you to go to the drugstore, get 2 dozen Cokes, a couple of quarts of ice cream, and a carton of cigarettes.
Carton of what?
Cigarettes.
You may not know it, but you got your best joke right there.
Say, Harry, it looks like I'm going to have to give Rochester a hand in the kitchen. Can you do something to entertain the boys?
Oh, well, I do swell imitations. Here, listen to this. Al Jolson.
That's an imitation of Al Jolson?
He's got a cold. I have an imitation of a man getting up in the morning.
Yeah?
Listen to this one, Eddie.
Well, Harry, where's the imitation?
Don't you get it? The guy felt lousy after New Year's Eve, so he stays in bed.
That's ridiculous, Harry.
Well, you're right there, Eddie. Feeling bad and not wanting to get up in the morning is ridiculous. It's ridiculous when it's so easy to feel better.
Just what do you mean?
Well, you know, Eddie, one glass of sparkling sal hepatica can make a man feel a lot better when he wakes up in the morning, feeling out of sorts and headachy due to the need of a laxative. For sal hepatica taken then brings quick, gentle relief, usually within an hour. That means you don't have to risk feeling miserable all day waiting until night to take a laxative. You take sal hepatica the minute you need it. What's more, sal hepatica gives you another advantage.
This famous saline helps sweeten an upset stomach by helping to reduce excess gastric acidity.
So tonight or tomorrow, get a bottle of sal hepatica from your druggist. Remembering this caution, use only as directed. Then whenever you need a laxative, morning, noon, or night, see how much faster you feel better thanks to gentle, speedy sal hepatica.
It's wonderful the way you help people feel better. But you know another way for you to help people feel better?
What, Eddie?
No more of your imitations.
Oh.
Remember that, Harry, huh? Wait a minute. Is that for me?
Yeah.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
It's no use. You I'm not talking to.
Russian, will you stop pouting? Why don't you come back? You can help Rochester in the kitchen.
Help Rochester? We couldn't work together because I wouldn't be able to understand a word he's saying.
Yeah. Why not?
That man is speaking with a dialect.
What do you think you speak with?
I speak...
I say, what do you think you speak with?
A southern drawl. You all...
Now, Russian, will you stop being stubborn and come back?
Kemper, we shall never be reconciled. Because of my southern drawl, I got a job on a different radio program.
A different program? What's the name of it?
We All the People.
Russian! Oh, well, let him quit, Harry. Thank goodness Jack loaned us Rochester to help him.
Yeah, that was sure nice of Jack.
Well, why not? After all, Jack, Benny, and I grew up doing favors for each other. Why, when we were kids, Harry, if Jack had a date and didn't have enough money to take his girl out, he'd come to me.
And you'd lend him the money?
No, I'd take his girl out.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Oh, hello, Rochester. Did you get everything from the store?
Yes, sir. Here's the ice cream. Here's the Coca-Cola.
Yes.
And here's some cigarettes.
And Rochester, where's my change?
And here's the ice cream.
I know. My change, Rochester.
Here's the Coca-Cola.
Where is my change?
Oh, they didn't have none of that.
Rochester, I want you to answer one question. Where is my change?
There's a question I'd like to kick around a while with information, please.
Rochester, what I sent you for cost $4. Now, what happened to the other dollar?
Well, it was an embarrassing situation. After all, Mr. Cannon, I couldn't let that stranger buy me a drink without me buying him a drink.
When did a stranger buy you a drink?
Right after I bought him a drink.
That is the most far-fetched thing I ever heard. Now, get busy in the kitchen while I go in and see how the gang is making out.
Hey, there he is. Hey, Cantor.
Hey, wait a minute. Hiya, fellas. I'm sorry I've been busy in the kitchen most of the night.
Hey, Cantor.
Yes, sailor.
Ain't you from New York?
Sure, I'm from New York. Where are you from?
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn, huh?
Yeah. Brooklyn.
Yeah?
New York is right near it.
And where are you from, soldier?
I'm from Pennsylvania.
I'm a Pennsylvanian, too.
Yeah? I'm from the greatest state in the world, Texas.
Oh, yeah, what about Michigan? What about Michigan? Hey, what about it?
Wait a minute, what's your home state, young fella?
Oklahoma, sir. The greatest place ever.
Yeah.
That's where the Illinois.
How about Wisconsin? Hey, Wisconsin's a good state.
Hey, wait a minute, fellas, wait a minute. I've got an idea. Let's make a game of this. I'd like to have you boys sing a song that has the name of your state in it. Don't worry about the music. Leonard Susan and his men will pick it up. Come on, you guys from Pennsylvania. What do you say?
Strike off the music. The band has begun. The Pennsylvania polka. Take out your partner and join in the fun. The Pennsylvania polka. Down by the Ohio. The train of life gets back to Ohio.
Back home again in Indiana, through the fields I used to roam.
Oh, the home of whirlwind comes sweeping down the plain. You're doing fine, Oklahoma, Oklahoma.
Smallest of the 48. You've got no prairie moon for which coyotes croon. But I still think that you're great. You're such a teensy weensy poor little Rhode Island. Let all the Texans yippee. You're still the best part of this land I dearly love. And I'll include Iowa. They've written songs about the South. They've written songs about the North. And I have heard them say there's nothing finer than Carolina in the morning. But how about the nice and cool little Rhode Island? Be careful if you're fancy free. In Providence one day, she stole my heart away. I dream of her constantly. Let the sun shine bright on your old Kentucky home. Rhode Island's the place for me. And here's another chorus.
Poor little Rhode Island. Be careful if you're fancy free.
In Providence one day, she stole my heart away. I dream of her constantly. California, here I go.
Way back east where they've got snow.
Poor little Rhode Island. That's the place for me.
Well, Rochester,
Everybody's gone. Party's over. It was a big success, thanks to you. Now, will you help me clean up?
I'm sorry, Mr. Cantor. I'd like to stay, but I got to go to a New Year's Eve party of my own.
Well, what time do you have to be there?
Don't make no difference. This one started last New Year's.
Oh, so that party's been going on since 1943. Tell me, Rochester, will the same gang still be there?
Just about. Of course, the draft board necessitated a few replacements.
That's very sad.
We got the host lit in the window waiting for him to come back.
Rochester, I'll do anything in the world if you stay and help me with this mess. I'll even get down on my knees and beg you.
Mr. Cantor, if you get down on your knees, don't beg me. Fade me.
All right, if that's what you want, Rochester, I have some dice.
Go ahead, boss. Never thought I'd get a crack at a millionaire. Well, Mr. Cantor, that's $200,000.
$200,000?
Don't worry, Mr. Cantor, I'm good for it.
Oh, I'm sure you are, Rochester.
Good night, Mr. Cantor.
Good night, Rochester.
Before I go, Mr. Cantor, about them dice, are you sure they was on the level?
Why, certainly, Rochester. There was nothing phony about those dice.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the first time I ever run up against a rug that was loaded.
Happy New Year, Rochester!
Happy New Year! Yes.
Each Wednesday with you, ask friend to friend. I'm sorry it's true. I'm telling you just how I feel. I hope you feel that way too.
Be sure and listen in next week when we bring you a show full of surprises, including those famous Andrew sisters. Now for an important message. Ladies and gentlemen, there are convoys loaded with desperately needed war materials that are not sailing, because the ships need experienced seamen. We must get those supplies to our fighting men. First mate, second mate, able-bodied seamen, and oilers are needed, and needed now. Wire collect, U.S. Merchant Marine, Washington, D.C. Get those convoys sailing so they can bring our men back faster. This is Eddie Cantor saying, good night, everybody. See you next week.
Say, Mother, if Junior is suffering from a cold, don't worry about it. Kids under 10 catch more colds than people in any other age group. But be sure and do something about it. Get a jar of Minute Rub and get after those cold symptoms. Rub Minute Rub on the back and chest, and it will help to soothe that cold discomfort. And Minute Rub's menthol vapors will help relieve that clogged feeling in nose and throat, too. What's more, Minute Rub is greaseless and stainless. It won't harm your clothes or linens. And Minute Rub is just as good for you as it is for your child. So why not get a jar of this modern chest rub, Minute Rub?
This is the National Broadcasting Company,
KFI Los Angeles.
The Eddie Cantor Show in a recording made off of KFI Los Angeles, as we just heard. Well, next we're going to play you a syndicated program called Favorite Story. This was hosted by Ronald Coleman, and he'd contact famous people of the time, and find out what their favorite story was. And then they'd do it for us so we could get a feeling for just what that person liked. This program is called The Glass Eye, and it's from 1949.
This is Ronald Coleman, inviting you to radio's most dramatic half hour, Favorite Story. Favorite Story invites you to hear a story discovery. It was found on a London bookstall by Jerome Robbins, the young choreographer who did such brilliant work in the Broadway hits On the Town, High Button Shoes, and Look, Ma, I'm Dancing. Robbins thought this yarn so unusual that he immediately sent us a copy and named it his favorite story. A half dozen cables have sped back and forth across the Atlantic to obtain the rights to dramatize this strange tale. So, for all of you who like your narratives on the startling side, here's John Keir Crossey's The Glass Eye. There are things that are funny so that you laugh at them. And there are things that are funny, but you don't laugh at them at all. You can take, for example, the case of Julia. Is it possible to laugh at people like Julia? I've never been able to. Yet Julia is funny. There's something funny in that gaunt shape, in those wide and earnest eyes, in the red, moist tip of that nose of hers that seems longer than any nose in the world. Julia is over 40, 42 to be exact. A friend of mine, a man who makes up verse for the magazines, wrote a poem about Julia. He called it To Julia, a song for a lost, mad girl. And it went like this. Oh, she thought she was in China and a million miles away, all among the tall pagodas where the shining geishas play, and the mockingbirds were singing and the lanterns burning red, and the temple bells were ringing softly, softly in her head. Now, Julia isn't really mad, just strange. You'd be strange, too, if you led the life Julia leads. I want you to hear a story about Julia. Since most of what happened is so terribly personal, let's climb the stairs to Julia's dusky little flat and sit down next to her, as if we weren't even there, and try to listen to what goes on inside her head.
It didn't happen. It never happened. I might have imagined it, you know. Yet this room is real enough. The yellow wallpaper stained with damp at the corners. The washstand. The gas ring a trifle rusty. The mantel shelf with the 8-day clock. And in front of it, on a square of velvet, the glass eye, his glass eye, as real as anything else in the room. No. I mustn't look at it. I mustn't keep it there as a terrible reminder. Why? It's the only memory I have. The only memory. It started late one summer. It was warm in London. I was working for Mr. Mofrey, a solicitor. I remember turning on my stool and waiting until he had finished writing a sentence in a law brief. Mr. Mofrey.
Yes, Miss Benson?
Would you mind, Mr. Mofrey, if I left about 20 minutes early this afternoon?
Oh? What's the special occasion, Miss Benson?
I have to meet a train. My sister's boy is coming to spend a few days with me. They live in Lister.
Oh, yes, that's the crippled lad, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Mofrey. My sister likes to spend a bit of time visiting her husband's people in Wales. And so Bernard comes to London. I do my best to show the poor little chap a good time.
That's very generous of you, Miss Benson. What sort of things do you do to amuse the lad?
I take him to the cinema. I buy him a toy. He's a quiet child. He doesn't ask for much.
Hunsaker down the hall mentioned that there was a good bill at the Old Palace Music Hall. I imagine the lad would like that. Acrobats and such. There's also a ventriloquist. One of those chaps who throws his voice.
Oh, that's a fine suggestion, Mr. Mofrey. I'll get tickets for tonight. Thank you very much, Mr. Mofrey. I met Bernard at his train. He was a very pale child, 11 years old. We had supper at the ABC tea shop. A mutton chop apiece and a large baked potato between us. It tasted good. Bernard said very little, but it was good to eat with someone else, with a guest. We went to the theater.
and sat in red plush stalls. There was an acrobat act, a man and a woman in white tights and spangled panties. I'm afraid I found it rather dull. Now, let me see, Bernard, what's next? Max Collodi, I guess you pronounce it. The gentleman ventriloquist with his amazing dummy, George. Oh, I think this will amuse you, Bennett. The curtain rose, and I saw him.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I and my talented little dummy here will be pleased to entertain you.
Watch out who you're calling a dummy, Max. You're not so smart yourself.
How about a song, George? A nice, smart song.
Don't mind if I do, Max, old man. Isn't he dull?
Go ahead, George.
Stop shoving me, Max. I'm going. There was I, awaiting at the church. Awaiting at the church. Awaiting at the church. This here girl, she looked...
As he sat there on the stage with the spotlight on him, I knew there was no one more handsome in the whole world than Max Collodi. His dark hair gleamed, his shoulders were so broad. George, the dummy on his knee, was a grotesque doll about 3 feet high. I hardly listened to their act. I just stared and stared at the incredibly handsome young man. And I knew then, because there could be no other man in all the world for me but the ventriloquist, Max Collodi. I took Bernard home as if I were in a dream. I gave him a cup of hot milk and put him to bed in a cot behind a curtain. Then I went to bed at the far side of the room. I lay for a long time staring at the ceiling, listening to the night sounds. Footsteps through the window from the street. The slow footsteps of a policeman. The strolling footsteps of lovers. Lovers. Lovers.
Oh, come on. Come on now.
And all the time I kept thinking, Max Collodi. Mrs. Max Collodi. Madam Collodi. Or is it Signora Collodi? Oh, footsteps mounting the stairs. The young man in the flat above coming home. But suppose I was Signora Collodi. Right now, I'm lying in the upper room of our villa in Italy. Max has been appearing at the theater. He's coming home now, dead tired. It's his footsteps coming up the stairs. In another moment, the door will open. He'll come in. He'll lean down and kiss me. I'll hold him very close. It is the young man upstairs. He's going into his flat. Signora Collodi. After Bernard went back to Lystra, I went to the music hall again. I prayed that Max Collodi would still be there. He was. He was. It was his last night. I sat so impatiently through the dreadful acrobat act. And then he came on. He came on. I didn't listen to his act at all. I just stared at him.
A ventriloquist doll am I. A ventriloquist doll, that's all.
And that's all you are, son.
Well, don't rub it in, man. Don't rub it in. A ventriloquist
doll. I didn't care what George was. It was Max, his master, I cared about. What a nice small bow he made. Such gentlemanly restraint. Bowing without standing up with the dummy still on his knee. They were applauding him, my Max. It was impossible to believe that anybody could be so handsome. I had to see him again. I had to know where he was going from here. I bought a copy of Stage. Here it is. Finsbury next week, then Streatham, Bradford, Blackpool. Yes. Yes. I'm going to do it. Mr. Murphy.
Yes, Miss Benson.
I wish to give my notice.
Huh?
I'm leaving your service.
Leaving, Miss Benson? Whatever for? Aren't you happy here?
I must be frank with you, Mr. Murphy. I am not. I'm leaving to go with the man I'm in love with. I said that so surely, so certainly, like a young girl. Oh, but I never would have said it if I knew then what I know now. As I sit here in the room with the yellow wallpaper, looking at that hideous thing on my mantelpiece, the glass art.
We're ready for Act Two of this week's favorite story. Lurene Tuttle stars as Julia in John Keir Cross's remarkable tale called The Glass Eye. Julia sits in the half-light of her room, hardly daring to look at her mantelpiece. For there, on a square of black velvet, is the glass eye.
Why did I do it? Years of loneliness, solitary meals, an ugly room with yellow wallpaper. No one to love. And then suddenly, Max Collodi. I had a small capital simply invested. I'd accumulated it through many years of saving. I drew it all out. I would live on this and follow Max Collodi around the country. Just looking at him, sitting there so handsome in the spotlight on the stage. Just looking at him was enough. I went to every performance he gave for weeks, paying my 3 shillings 6, sitting in the darkness, looking at the light. But then I felt I had to meet him. Maybe. If I were bold enough, I would even go up to him and say, Mr. Collodi, I enjoy your performance very much. And perhaps even shake his hand quickly for just a moment. At Streatham, I got up enough courage and waited at the stage entrance in the shadows.
Good night,
Pop. You're on performance tonight. Mark those boobs out front on a window chuckle.
Two little things here.
I watched them all go out. The acrobat, the fat lady who rode the bicycle in the closing act. The juggler with the funny ears. But no. No Max Collodi. I waited a long time. They started to turn out all the lights. The old man at the stage door started to lock up the theater. I walked up to him slowly.
Who's that?
I beg your pardon, sir. I'm sorry to bother you.
Yes. What do you want?
I know you'll think this is very odd. But can you tell me if Max Collodi has come out yet?
You're waiting for Max Collodi?
Yes.
Well, that's a good one. She's waiting for Max Collodi.
I knew I wasn't good enough for him. People would laugh. I was old, and he was young and handsome. But even so, I wrote Max Collodi a letter. I wrote it very carefully. I told him how much I enjoyed his performance and wondered if perhaps I might be privileged to meet him. Days later, I received a reply. I tore open the letter. My dear Miss Benson, I am grateful for your praise. I regret to say, however, that I never grant interviews. Cordially yours, Max Colodi. Oh. But I kept going to his performances, and I kept on writing to him. It surprised me very much that he went on replying. And as time passed, he seemed to grow warmer in his letters, even friendly. Once, in Bradford, he asked me to send him a photograph. I found a blurred snapshot of myself. In it, I appeared on a lawn against a background of fuchsia and veronica bushes, very shy, with my head to one side. It was a very old snapshot, a daylight exposure print on matte paper. People had said in those days that it was a dead-spit image of me. The bobbed hair caught up in a bandeau of Japanese silk. The frock was no waist that ended above the knee. The earrings of emerald-cut glass. But it was a picture of me at 23. I shouldn't have sent it. The whole thing wouldn't have happened if I hadn't sent that. It was at Blackpool that I finally met Max Colodi. I'd been suggesting again and again in my letters that someday we might meet. And finally a letter came. A very special letter. I ripped it open. Dear Miss Benson, I believe that I might grant you a short interview, but we must make certain conditions. You are to stay only for 5 minutes this first time. Later on, perhaps, if you still wish to go on seeing me, we might arrange longer appointments. I wish to state at this time that I have an aversion in real life to strong light, being so much in my professional life under the glare of the limes and the footlights. So my hotel room will be dimly lit. If you do not mind being received in a half-lit hotel bedroom by a strange man with no other chaperone beside my dummy, George. My... Then would you come to the Seabank Temperance Hotel, Mortimer Street, Blackpool, at 10 p.m. on Saturday evening next, after my show at the Winter Garden Theatre. At that time, I will be happy to tell you something about myself, and to hear in return something about you. Oh, I'm going to meet him. I'm going to meet Max Colodi. That Saturday I spent in front of the mirror at the boarding house where I was staying. But powder and lip rouge, used discreetly, of course, could not make me look 23 again. All the makeup in the world couldn't keep me from looking 42. I spent hours of agony before I could make up my mind what to wear. In the end, I knew there was no hope of looking like the snapshot. And I blessed Max for suggesting that the room be dim, that the interview last only 5 minutes. At 10 minutes to 10, I was walking up and down in a dark place near his hotel. It was the longest 10 minutes I had ever spent in my life. I glanced at my watch. 2 minutes to 10. I pushed open the swinging door of the hotel and walked up to the reception desk.
Yes, lady?
Could you tell me the number of Mr. Max Colodi's room, please?
The number 7 on the first floor. Stairway to your left.
As I walked across the lobby, I felt his eyes on my back. I mounted the stairs, taking care not to trip over the worn carpet. I dabbed at the tip of my nose with a small scented handkerchief. At a roses from Boots at 4 and 6 the bottle. Number 5. Number 6. Number 7.
Come in.
was sitting behind a large mahogany table. Even in the dim light, I could not mistake him. He was so handsome. He didn't get up. He just inclined his head in a brusque, slightly stiff way I knew so well. It was the bow with which he acknowledged applause in the theater.
Dear lady, pray sit down.
Thank you. I didn't know what to say. What was there to say? To gain time, I quickly glanced around the room. An ordinary room with flowered wallpaper. There was a bed, a wardrobe, a small chest of drawers. Rolled grotesquely on a chair to Max's left was the dummy George. So lifeless there in the half-light. Mr. Collodi.
Max Collodi at your service.
Mr. Collodi, my voice sounded thin and false. Not myself speaking at all, but someone else. Someone else in my body. Trembling, aching, sickened stomach. And suddenly this swept into me as I sat there. A terrible and overwhelming desire. I wanted to touch Max Collodi. Just to touch him once. To touch his hands, his forehead, his blue-tinted jaw. It was a craving so terrible I could not resist. I got up. I stood for a moment staring wildly, hardly breathing. I walked quickly around the table.
Madam, what are you doing?
I touched him on the cheek and... He toppled sideways and fell from his chair. Dummy George was standing up on a chair, his hideous face twisted with rage. And as I stared, I realized that the dummy George was a living creature. And that what I had loved was nothing but wood and claws and glass. At last I had met Max. Collodi, the ventriloquist. I stared at the dummy on the floor, the beautiful staring face I had loved so much. One eye was gone and sawdust poured from his head, but it still smiled. And all the time that misshapen dwarf was weeping. That unlovable thing, the real Max Collodi, who had worked the movements of that handsome mouth with strings and wires. How could he have hoped to get away with it? He who was as hungry for affection as I was. I started to run from the room. My foot trod on something round and hard. I stooped and picked it up. Then ran screaming from the hotel. It was the glass eye. The glass eye of the thing on the floor. The glass eye that rests now as a terrible relic on its black velvet pants on my mantelpiece.
Now that is a story. Tell me honestly, did you ever think that the real ventriloquist would turn out to be just a dwarf? And that the big handsome man was really only the dummy? Well, it had me surprised. That's what we call a switch ending, and it's the kind that would have made O. Henry proud indeed. Loreen Tuttle is to be warmly congratulated for her fine acting as Julia, and Byron Kane deserves a bow for his portrayal of Max Collodi, both sizes. Claude Sweeten, as always, composed and conducted the music. Jerome Lawrence and Robert E. Lee wrote and directed this pre-radio adaptation of John Keir Cross's The Glass Eye. Our thanks also to choreographer Jerome Robbins, who chose The Glass Eye as this week's favorite story.
That's it for this week. We'll be back next week with more old-time radio. I hope you can join us then. Till then, this is Jim Dolan thanking you for listening.